A few weeks ago, I got a press release from a publisher announcing that the son of the infamous Sam Shepard, one of the most talked-about convicts of the century, has just written a book that might finally prove once and for all that his father was really innocent. So I threw it in the trash. Because, like many Americans who grew up in the 1950s, I knew that Sam Shepard was guilty. Until the O.J. Simpson trial, this was the murder case of the century. Back in 1954, the whole nation was mesmerized by the story of how this successful doctor named Sam Shepard had bludgeoned his wife Marilyn to death in their bed after a 4th of July picnic at their house on the shores of Lake Erie. At least, that was the prosecution's story. The media reported it as fact, and the jury convicted Sam Shepard and put him in jail. 10 years later, the Supreme Court ruled that the media's circus-style coverage had denied Shepard a fair trial. So he went to court again, represented by a young lawyer named F. Lee Bailey. And he was acquitted. The case inspired the TV series and movie, The Fugitive. But hardly any Americans really believed Shepard was innocent. They figured a smart lawyer got him off. So Shepard was shunned, he sank into alcohol, and he died a lonely death a few years later. In any case, I finally got a copy of the new book by Shepard's son, Sam Reese Shepard, and lawyer-journalist Cynthia Cooper, and it is compelling. Over the last few years, they've joined forces with a detective agency and turned up evidence that a number of law enforcement officials agree does suggest that Shepard was in fact innocent. And not just that, they think they've discovered who might have really murdered Marilyn Shepard, and they name him. Sam Reese Shepard was 7 years old that morning in July 1954.
I woke up to the urgent urging of a panicked adult, and I'm not sure whether that was an aunt or an uncle. They had never been in my bedroom before. It was very strange that they were awakening me. I was told I had to get up immediately and leave the house. I didn't have time to put on my clothes. I was ushered out of my bedroom to the right into the hallway where a policeman was standing blocking my view into the doorway into that room. And then I was ushered to what we called the back door. That was the Lake Road side of the house, where I stepped out on the stoop. And that is a frozen moment of time for me. That is a time where, I guess, for me, the axis of the universe shifted and that I somehow knew that I had lost everything at that moment.
And, of course, upstairs in your parents' bedroom, your mother is lying dead, a horribly grisly scene.
Right. She was 4 months pregnant at the time.
And the way Sam Shepard told the story, he went home from the hospital that July 4th. The family had a picnic dinner with his favorite blueberry pie. He stayed up for a while to watch television with his wife and friends, but soon fell asleep on a couch. When the friends left, his wife Marilyn tried to rouse him. He grunted and went back to sleep, and she went upstairs to bed.
He was awakened by some screams in the night, Sam, Sam, or of that sort. He immediately thought that my mother was having convulsions because she had had trouble carrying me in her pregnancy previously to that. He rushed upstairs, saw a vague shape in the room, and of course his concentration was on my mother, and he walked into the room and got it heavily in the back of the head, probably a karate chop of some sort. He was knocked out cold for some time. He came to, reached for my mother, felt her pulse, felt she was gone, I think, at that point. He heard noises downstairs. He went down the stairs, ran into the living room, pursued a figure across, out the front door to the lake. They struggled. He was knocked unconscious again.
And this is according to your father's version.
Right. And lay there half in and out of the water. Came groggily to, I think, discover that he didn't have his T-shirt on at that point. And struggled up the stairs. A name and number popped into his head, which was the phone number of the mayor of Bay Village, who was a close personal friend. Called that number and said, I believe I quote, "Spen, come quick, I think they've killed Marilyn," unquote.
The prosecution attacked Shepard's story on a few major points. First of all, they said, police could find no evidence that somebody had broken into the house. And if nobody broke in, then it must have been an inside job. And then there were Shepard's lies. He had told prosecutors that his marriage was fine and he hadn't had any affairs, But it turned out he'd had sex with a lab technician in one of his expensive cars. Then a few years ago, lawyer and journalist Cynthia Cooper started looking into the case for an article. And the more she dug, she says, the more the original prosecution and police stories unraveled. When she asked to look through old police files on the case, local government officials refused, and she had to sue them to get access.
The Bay Village police said it had files, but that it was, they called it an open case and claimed that that provided some kind of exception under the Freedom of Information laws. In fact, there is no exception under the Freedom of Information laws in Ohio for an open case. So it was merely obstinacy. They did not want these files open because I believe they understood that there was information in there that showed how wrongful the prosecution had been.
Okay, and some of that information was, for one thing, that whereas during the trial the prosecution had said and the police had said there was no sign of forced entry into the house, right, you guys discovered that in fact, according to a buried police report, they had found a sign of forced entry.
Exactly.
Sam Reese Shepherd.
Exactly, that there were signs of pry marks on a basement entryway. And that
pry marks made by like a crowbar or something,
right, or a burglar's tool of some sort. And Ms. Cooper went and interviewed the detective who made out that report. The detective actually took a plasticine cast of these marks and
in 1954
and filed it with the police and never to be heard from again. And yet, on the other hand, the strategy of the prosecution, one of its high points, was to say that there was no sign of break-in.
May I mention another piece of evidence All that right. came out of the trial? Whereas Sam Shepherd said that he struggled with the mysterious form on the beach and fell unconscious into the water, and when he came to, he was missing his T-shirt, the police said, well, where's the T-shirt? Nobody can find it, right?
That's what the police said. I hasten to point out that a T-shirt was found on the beach. It was not allowed to be tested by the defense. The prosecution discounted this T-shirt. Imagine first they'd already decided Dr. Shepherd was guilty and what the T-shirt should look like. The T-shirt should have looked like it was covered with blood. Whoever killed Mrs. Shepherd was covered with blood. This T-shirt had no blood on it. It was ripped completely up the side as if it had been pulled off. And so the police discounted it because they said it had no blood on it. Where, in fact, it was evidence. It was evidence that pointed to innocence and corroborated Dr. Shepherd's story.
And shortly after the murder, police found fresh signs that someone had torn through the bushes between Shepherd's house and the lake, possible signs of an intruder. But the police not only hid the report, they cut down all the bushes. And there was the matter of the blood. The police had found a pattern of blood drops going from the Shepherd's bedroom all the way down the stairs. But they'd never bothered to type the blood to see if it came from Marilyn Shepherd or Sam or somebody else. And perhaps most important, Cooper and Shepherd's son and other investigators have turned up a man in prison who was convicted of bludgeoning a woman to death in the 1980s. The victim's sister was also battered to death years earlier, although that crime has never been solved. And it turns out that this convict worked for the Shepherd family. He had washed their windows shortly before Marilyn Shepherd was murdered. Like something out of a movie, Cynthia Cooper has developed an eerie relationship with this convict, a man named Richard Eberling, and she says he's told her detailed information about Marilyn Shepherd's death.
I have just tried to talk to him and to let him open up, and to he hasn't talked to anybody else about this murder, and I have just tried to talk to him person to person, and he has a lot of disturbing personal knowledge about the murder, where he can describe events and activities that might have occurred.
So the point is, he is telling you, right, in great detail, a lot of facts about the case, which would be very hard for anybody who wasn't there to know.
That's correct. Not only this murder, at least one other murder as well. He also makes a number of very disturbing statements. He's told me that he could describe the actions of the killer. One time he told me that the killer had not meant to commit murder, but he was just trying to thrash out some devil or demon inside. He's talked about the thrashing of the legs of the victim. A lot of statements that are just frightening in a way. I mean, they're a little more specific than someone with sort of a television knowledge of the case.
Cooper says she's never asked Eberling point blank, did you murder Marilyn Shepherd? She says she's afraid he'll close up. But he has told a critical detail. He says it was his blood on the Shepherd stairway that police found after the murder. He says he cut his hand working on their house. Prosecutors in Cuyahoga County, where the Shepherds lived, are troubled enough by these findings that they've asked the court to order convict Richard Eberling to contribute some blood so they can compare his DNA with old blood samples found in the Shepherd's home. All this raises a question. Why did another generation of prosecutors and police back in the 1950s go to such lengths to convict Sam Shepherd in the first place, given the evidence?
My mother and dad were very flamboyant people at that time. My dad had been trained in California. My dad had had certain affairs. He owned a Jaguar car. A lot of people were kind of jealous of him. They were out of step in terms of their social times in the Bible Belt of Ohio at that time. But very quickly, it happens today, a high-profile case spins out of control. And hatred and hysteria rise in the community. When a pregnant woman dies in an ugly way in our community, people are stricken with fear, and rightfully so, or certainly rationally so. And that arose up very quickly, and the blame on my dad got pinpointed by the newspapers very quickly.
So essentially you're saying the police, the prosecution, the community looked for the nearest convenient scapegoat.
Yes.
To this terrible crime.
Exactly.
Your father's life and your mother's life, of course, were not the only lives ruined by this case. Several of your family members, one of them committed suicide.
Several. Yes,
after the trial.
Well, after my dad was convicted, my grandmother's darling youngest son, my grandfather became ill with massive gastric ulcers and was in the hospital dying. My grandmother, a very modest, shy, religious woman, had been shocked and traumatized. She could not face the immorality of her youngest son having been unfaithful to his wife, for example. She killed herself. I heard the shot that day. A few years later, my mother's father committed suicide by shotgun. We had at least three serious alcoholics later on in the family, two serious drug addicts that I know of now.
Related, and, you think, to the shame of the trial?
The trauma. And this relates to me, I relate it to my activism against the death penalty. This kind of trauma and shock and the terrorism involved destroys lives. It renders them dysfunctional. I mean, I myself have looked over those edges in terms of the emotional problems, the post-traumatic stress disorder that I've had to live through and survive through this case. I've been very lucky to be where I am.
So what do you want now? Is there any official action that you want somebody in the government to take, saying, you know, we have now determined based on the facts that Sam Shepherd was really innocent? Or
absolutely, yes. Well, we're waiting. We have filed, my lawyer, Terry Gilbert, in Cleveland, Ohio, and I filed a petition for a declaration of innocence from the civil court. So I would certainly hope that we can get that declaration. And I would certainly hope that the people in Ohio, the system, can stand up and have the integrity and the guts to stand up and compensate our family monetarily. Stand up and say, I'm sorry. I mean, that just that simple fact alone would mean one heck of a lot.
Samri Shepherd and Cynthia Cooper. Their new book is called Mockery of Justice.